race is on, and the 2021 Formula One season blasted into life with the first day of pre-season testing in Bahrain. But unusually, it was Mercedes in the wars on day one, while Red Bull and Max Verstappen set the pace. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to look back at all the action are Gary Anderson and Mark Hughes. Well, Gary, it's a bit different for you as you're not on the ground here in Bahrain, primarily because the COVID restrictions mean you wouldn't be able to get anywhere near the cars anyway, so what's the point? But there's been no lack of technical intrigue, has there, given the amount of stuff you've been writing for the Races website and the amount I've been bothering you today about things?
No, lots of technical stuff, but the most interesting thing, I think, was the sandstorm. I mean, you could have been in the beats there, couldn't you? That has to upset everything. The wind was quite high level, and the sand obviously changed the grip levels dramatically, so... a difficult test for everybody, I think. But, you know, we saw a bit more of what the cars looked like right at this point in time. If you took a snapshot today, that was what we had. And their performance was what they had. Obviously, fuel load-wise and that, we've got really no ideas. But it was a tough day, so I think that everybody kept their head down. And you know, sensible laps from everybody, no stupid mistakes. Everything looked okay. And as I say, it was nice to see the cars fully up to running performance, speed, and technically at that level.
Yeah, I'm told that the weather conditions will be a little bit better tomorrow, so we'll see how that goes on. But Mark, you've also been following from afar while I've been dealing with the flying sand here in Bahrain. Not the ideal conditions for testing, but as I'm sure we'll get to in a minute, there's still a little bit to be learned from today.
A little bit, yeah. Obviously, pretty wildly skewed by several things, the sandstorm among them, the wind, and the fact that Mercedes ended up being sort of half a day behind everyone else. And so, yeah, it's difficult to gauge everyone else when you're not sure where Mercedes is at, because for sure it's not at where it appears to be in the timesheets. But yeah, we saw enough to have some more maybe focused questions rather than any definitive answers.
It's difficult to believe that Mercedes are where they are, and obviously they had a gearbox problem, so they lost half a day as such. But it did seem that the second half of the day was actually slightly faster than the first half of the day, even through all that sand. The track there's got a lot of grip, so it's not as bad as somewhere like Magny-Cours or Silverstone if you've got a lot of sand on it. But the one thing I would say is that, you know, with the wind, I think the cars that have got high-performance aerodynamics will suffer more. Because the reason you get high performance aerodynamics on the car's surface is because your stress on the surface is more than other people. You're making them work harder. All your vortex generations, all much more defined, much more addressed, I suppose you might call it, to the solutions that you're trying to find from it. And when you get the wind, that's just like turbulence in a way. It just hurts a lot more surfaces. So the cars that are reasonably benign as far as stressing the aerodynamic surface are concerned, I think, get off better with the wind conditions. So it'll be interesting to see if we do get a calmer day tomorrow, whether Mercedes can just shut the gap down. But it might just be a learning curve for them. They might have to take note of what happened today, even though it's not their true performance. They might just have to take note of it because it can happen, and it can happen very, very quickly.
I think the other thing that was difficult with the wind is it kind of came and went. So sort of 1 second it would be blowing, and then it would just sort of die away. Then it would come back. So it was that sort of buffety wind. It was a sort of tailwind down start finish and a headwind on the kind of middle straight, for want of a better word. So, yeah, a little bit of variability doesn't help. Before we get into the details, for what it's worth, headline numbers. Max Verstappen, fastest for Red Bull, 1:30.674. Lando Norris for McLaren, second, 0.215 seconds slower. Esteban Ocon, third for Alpine, 0.472 seconds off the pace. And Lance Stroll, 1.108 seconds down for Aston Martin. 17 drivers ran, 16 race drivers. The exception was Williams test driver Roy Nissany. Obviously, Mercedes' struggles was probably the biggest story, but we know headline times mean very, very little, Mark, and that's probably being generous to say very little. You've been crunching the numbers to try and get a few little pointers. So what have we learned, and what have you been able to draw from that to target your ongoing questions, if you want to look at it that way?
There was probably Red Bull, Alpha, Williams did comparable runs on the same duration of runs on the same tyre at roughly the same time. And from that, we saw an average over 14 laps of just under 1:37, so 36.9 for Red Bull. 38.3 for a 16-lap run from Alpha, and a 38.4 from a shorter 10-lap run from Williams. So, you know, that's sort of roughly in the ballpark of where those teams would have been relative to each other last year. So they're the sort of hard points that we have. The others, we didn't see representative long runs from, you know, the interesting ones that we'd like to see in comparison to the Red Bulls, such as Mercedes, Aston Martin, and McLaren, etc., for various reasons, all on different programs. But yeah, it looked that those three separate long runs seemed to give an average about relative to each other, where about where you'd expect them to be.
And obviously, Gary, you haven't had much chance to look at the numbers as yet. You normally do, but you might have had a chance to have a brief preliminary look. Anything you've drawn from it?
Yeah, I mean, I have had a bit of a look, and I go for the other side from Mark. I go for just the out-and-out performance, really. Obviously, fuel load makes a big difference in that, but comparing things to last year. And one of the interesting things is last year, Hamilton had the fastest lap, obviously pole position, 1:27.264. And at the moment, it's Verstappen at a 1:30.674. So there's 3.9%. I'm going into percentages here because it's easier to equate rather than lap time. 3.9% difference from this year to last year's fastest lap. But in the race, Verstappen was the fastest last year at 1:32.014. So that's 5.44%. So, you know, they're in between those two lap times, which is what we'd expect. They've lost a little bit of downforce. The tyres are sort of, you know, a bit different, a bit unexplained in a way what the difference really is, but it's what they've got now. So they sort of latched in there to the middle of those two times between the qualifying time from last year and the race time from last year. I mean, we know when we looked at the test from last year and tried to equate that with fuel loads that I looked at a little bit before this test, you know, the Alfa Romeo did run very low fuel in testing last year. So there's no reason why they'll change their strategy this year. So I'm sure they're, you know, they are, when they're running for the fastest laps, they're running on a reasonably low fuel load. But interesting, if you take Verstappen's time this year, McLaren, obviously second quickest at the minute, only 0.2 of a percent behind Verstappen. And last year they were 1.4% behind, and it would be Mercedes. And then we've got the Renault come Alpine, if you like to call it, at 0.5%. Aston Martin, 1.2%. 1.222%, actually. And interestingly, last year, they were 1.212% behind Mercedes. So relatively to the fastest car, very close. Now, all these numbers mean nothing because it's day one and a lot of sand and a lot of wind and all sorts of stuff. But you go through it and, you know, you end up with Ferrari down there in 5th position, 1.3% behind Verstappen. And last year they were 2.1%. So, you know, I think that's sort of relatively, they're running the same sort of fuel load, those two. And, you know, they have made progress, Ferrari, but that's the sort of progress they've made, which is, you know, 0.8%, which is not enough to get them into that battle at the front, really, but enough to get them at the battle at the front of the second group. So, again, we need to let more time go on, but it's unfolding, I think, that, you know, in my book, that McLaren have made some progress. Renault last year were one of the lightest fuel loads as well, testing in Barcelona. So I think that their time is based on the fact that they're still running low fuel or lowish fuel. Aston Martin's fairly real. Ferrari's fairly real. Alfa have made progress, but again, they're running low fuel. Alfa Tauri, they're a little bit slower than they were before, but I think that would be expected because Gasly ran the morning and then the other guy took over in the afternoon, and he's new. I think he did a very competent job, to be honest, in those conditions, but you know, he needs more time to settle in and just take the risks that you need. And then obviously Mercedes were having a bit of a mare, but I don't think it was I think it's a learning curve for them. You know, I think it's what they had today was a bit of a mare. but they'll put that into the pot and stir it and come out with some solutions. I mean, those last three laps, I think, of Lewis Hamilton's, where he made mistakes on all three of them, similar sort of mistake, just basically couldn't get the car to stop, just couldn't get the bite out of the brakes and the tires. It was very consistently bad. But if you look at Max Verstappen, he started this morning with the same sort of situation. He had a lot of problems, and he basically thought immediately, cool, they're going into this season with the same problems as they had last year. But it all cleared up. So it'll be interesting to see what Sergio Perez thinks of the car, because you call him a normal, quick driver, whereas you call Max Verstappen somebody fairly exceptional.
Yeah, so the Red Bull looked better and better relative to the competition as the track improved, I thought. As you say, it really did look very similar to last year's at the same point, didn't it? At first, with understeer going in, and then suddenly it was spinning. As the track grip improved, it started to load up a bit more, you could see. But the Mercedes, it just wouldn't load up at all, and it had no traction, and just looked like a car that wasn't generating tire temperature, tire window, was it? I think that's another one of the question marks we've got. We don't really see Mercedes probably even running in the proper temperature of the tire. So that can sway things by whole seconds, can't it? So yeah.
But you know, that's their job, to get the car there. I mean, if you take this, what we saw with the Red Bull at the beginning, the understeer, that's what happens when you got a bit of understeer into the corner, mid corner, you put a little bit more steering lock on because you get the understeer. Then as you're exiting the corner, you need to straighten the steering wheel up. And at some point in time, when you're taking the steering lock off, the front tire will grip again. And that's when it spits the rear out. So, you know, very often the driver will complain about the oversteer on corner exit, but actually it's coming from understeer mid corner. So you've just got to be very careful. You know, it can all start from oversteer turning in because you're catching the rear of the car, and then mid corner you've actually got to put a little bit more steering lock on and you get the understeer, and then on the exit you get the front tire biting and it spits the rear out. So it can be a very complicated balance setup change through the corner that you need to do, but Red Bull seem to get on top of it for sure. The interesting thing for me as well was the fact that the higher rate cars didn't seem to be suffering as much as I expected them to. I thought with this floor change, the higher rate cars might suffer that a bit more. But if you take a general view through the performance today, the higher rate cars were okay.
But it is amazing for Mercedes, because we're so used to them just running thousands of laps on the first day out the box. 48 laps in total they managed, just six for Bottas in the morning. He had a gearbox problem. Then he got out right at the end of the morning just to do a few little bits and pieces. Hamilton, 42 laps. He had a pedal adjustment. There were some balance changes they were chasing. And then, of course, the sandstorm. Can't blame the team for that. Very unusual for Mercedes. But, Gary, they were the only team who didn't do a shakedown. And I must admit, I didn't think that was really an issue, because they had multiple teams running their engine to make sure everything was running okay. Do you think this is a case that you could say, had they done that promotional day, they'd have picked up this gearbox gremlin and they'd probably have racked up 140 laps today rather than 48?
Well, yes and no. You know, one of these things that they do with these gearboxes is get them to sort of learn their gear positions. And that all happens sort of on the warm or the installation lap or the first lap out of the pits. And that's really what happened to them. So I think that the problem was probably caused by a deeper problem of the learning of the gear positions, because with this with the auto shift, or the full torque shift, when the driver instigates it, the system does everything, and unless that gear position is well and truly defined, it can really make a mess of the gearbox. So if they went out and the learning curve didn't work properly, then that could have happened even after an installation run, or it could happen at any point in time after you leave the pits anywhere. So, because you always do that learning curve. So I'm not sure that a filming day would actually have got rid of the problem they had. Don't know the problem that they had 100%, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was it. So suddenly they were finding themselves with potentially a gearbox disaster, but coming from a very small problem. And it just could be software. So in reality, they didn't want to take a risk, so they changed the gearbox, because it probably had a couple of attempts at finding the right gear position, and made a bit of a mess of a gear change or something, which you can't take the risk on because you can blow the gearbox apart from. So putting a fresh gearbox on during that same period in time, they'd looked at the software and saw why it wasn't learning properly and done something with it, because that's what you have to do. So I'm not sure it would have fixed the problem. Might have given them more confidence that the problem wasn't really a real problem, but they didn't do it, so they have to get on with the best thing they can.
Well, as Andrew Shovlin said, their trackside engineering director, it's been a poor start to the season for us today. At least that's something a little bit different, because you have to go all the way back probably to 2014 and that first test for these engines. Remember Gary S hanging around at the pit exit at Jerez waiting for somebody to go out, and Mercedes did get going and then their front wing failed, so they didn't get so many laps in. So it's good to go back to slightly different times. I have to say, Ferrari, I was sort of moderately encouraged by, not in terms of joining that front group, but Carlos Sainz, spoke to him after the session. He seemed relatively happy with the way the car was behaving. It was doing everything he expected within the fact that the conditions were a bit dreadful. But obviously, like everyone, they're not pushing into those last sort of few tenths and really pushing those corner entries. And it's the corner entries where you really hit the limitations of the car. So probably reason for Ferrari to be relatively upbeat. Anyone else sort of catching your eye for good reasons or bad, Mark?
I think the AlphaTauri in the first session looked really nicely drivable, and the McLaren looked nicely drivable. Just looking at the body language of the cars, I think it would have been, where by the time Tsunoda got in it, they had, an issue with the fuel pump or fuel delivery, some sort of. So it was running in fairly detuned form when he got in it. But it was impressive that it could do that straight out of the box. Same with the McLaren Mercedes, and also the number of laps that Ocon put in the Alpine.
Should we talk about a few technical points? The first thing, Gary, the Alpine, obviously everyone was very interested in how wide that airbox is. You were very uncomplimentary about it. Obviously, there are reasons for it. Of course, there would be. They have put some stuff up higher there, which doesn't sound great for centre of gravity, but obviously it pays you back a little bit lower down the car, so maybe that improves the airflow. But what do you make of that? Is there any reason to go that way? And would you be worried if you're Alpine? Because the way I look at it, if Mercedes had done that, you'd think, well, they are Mercedes, so maybe if they're the outlier, they've come up with something. If Red Bull did it, you might think, yeah, they might not have implemented it perfectly yet, but it's probably a reason for that. But Alpine, you sort of get a little bit worried when you see them going off the beaten track.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there's lots of stuff underneath the bodywork that we never see, but I haven't seen the sort of compactness of the coke bottle area or the side pods that sort of justify the bulge in the engine cover. You know, normally the two go together. You've either got the bits down inside the side pod, or you've got the bits up high. Now, yeah, if you put them up high, you use the airflow from through it's the excess airflow that's going in the airbox to cool those componentry. And if it's in the side pod, you use the airflow through the side pod. The airflow through the side pod is much better for producing, the airflow reduction through the side pod is much better for producing downforce than any change in airflow through the airbox. So that's the way you would go for sure, but not at, you know, not at a great cost. You wouldn't want to raise the center of gravity of these cars because, you know, they're quite well defined as far as the engine center of gravity is concerned, all that sort of stuff. So you can't really have a massive difference. And the last thing from a general car layout, and the last thing you want to do is just raise it for the sake of raising it. We used to spend all our time trying to lower it for the, you know, and you get a result out of it. And mainly you get a result out of it over long runs. When you got a lower center of gravity, the tire degradation is better than if you've got a high center of gravity. It'll work on one lap, okay. It doesn't really care. And actually, to be honest, high center of gravity can be better on one lap because you put more load into the tires, you get them working better, quicker. But unfortunately, that has the other side of falling away as the tire gets used a bit more. So maybe their problems are still to come. And again, it's a bit like the Williams. You know, they've made that part of the car bulbous, because you have to get the hot air from the back of the radiator out the back of the car. And if you take that out down low, you end up with a lesser coke bottle solution. So they could have done that, but I don't see the lesser coke bottle solution to justify it. So I'll bide my time to see what happens really with it. it's not the most elegant solution, but to be honest, you know, it's small detail. If there is a deficit with it, it'll be over long runs for sure with the tires. Aerodynamically, you probably couldn't read the difference, but it makes a difference over that long run for the tire degradation, and that's such a big part of racing these days.
And of course, Ocon was in that car all day today. We'll see Fernando Alonso out tomorrow. He turned up in a press conference today, said he's got a few bits of titanium in his face that he's going to have taken out at the end of the year, but otherwise he seems to be all right after his cycling accident. So interesting to see how he gets on tomorrow. But Mark, before we get a bit more in depth with Gary, technically wise, anything really catch your eye? Obviously lots of different floor designs out there, different approaches there.
I thought it was quite interesting, the ostensible similarity of the floor on the Mercedes and the Aston Martin. And I was wondering, did Gary think that was there might be a common denominator of being low-rate cars? Is that going to be part of the floor that you would devote your attention to there on a low-rate car?
It could be. I am a bit surprised they're so similar, because it's not a simple sort of thought pattern that gets you there. On most cars, they have this turned up outside of the front of the floor, in that first sort of third of the floor area. They pull airflow through the front corner of the floor and generate some downforce in that area, which sort of helps the front wing because it's slightly in front of the middle of the car, so it's front downforce it generates. But it also means the diffuser, because the diffuser is a lot smaller than if you had a free hand in designing one of these cars. You would not design a diffuser the size it is now. You'd design it much, much bigger. So the diffuser is a lot smaller than these cars would normally have. So you want to, you know, you add all that together, the sort of front corner diffuser, the rear diffuser, and you add all that to the low pressure that's underneath the floor of the car, and it gives you the suction or the ground effect that you want to create downforce. So because there is going to be more leakage under the floor than there was before, you're wanting to make that front corner work harder if you can, because the total sum of that low pressure underneath that big floor area is what you're trying to increase or decrease, if you want to call it. So there's very few ways of doing that. You can't make a diffuser bigger. All these turning vanes that they have on the trailing edge of the diffuser, they're all sort of extra to the height because they're inside the diffuser as such. They don't overhang the diffuser. So they turn the airflow above the diffuser and try to make the diffuser think it's bigger than what it really is. So whether it's, you know, whether it's pulling more airflow out of that front corner or generating vortexes that pull more airflow out of that front corner, or help seal the rest of the floor, it's all the same thought pattern that you're trying to do. Would that sort of fit with a low rate car more than a high rate car? I don't see the reason for that, because if it does help seal the floor, the high rate car will benefit from it as well, and maybe even more. If it does generate more downforce in that front corner, the high rate car will benefit from it, and maybe even more again. So at the end of the day, I think it's just ideas and how it's got to there now with the different solutions. If you look at the back part of the Aston Martin against the McLaren have got sort of the little more or less vertical turning vanes with a top element on it to try and turn that airflow up and get it connected up to the rear brake duct. And on the Aston Martin, it's just got vertical turning vanes. So everybody's got their own interpretation. I think, you know, it'll take us maybe to Imola or something before we see everything focusing in one, more or less one direction. But now that, you know, the lights are on, everybody can see everything. So now we'll see who's scratching in the wind tunnel to try and create some bets, even for Sunday in Bahrain.
One of the things, Gary, that was suggested, I think Karim Chandhok and Martin Brundle were apparently talking about this in the coverage, was that the high rake works because less control over the tyre squirt because you haven't got the subtlety in the floor and the slots and the length. So could that be something that you're not sort of trading off so much anymore? You've lost something, so you might as well go with the high rake anyway.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, the high rake does mean the diffuser itself is further away from the ground, and the floor itself, you know, is more angled to the ground. It will mean the centre of pressure of the underfloor is probably a bit further forward, which is, you know, no bad thing as such, but it's not necessarily that good a thing. The problem is with the gap from the floor to the ground. If any team in the pit lane could close that gap up, they would. So it's a matter of the size of the gap between the side of the floor and the ground relative to the amount you can accelerate the airflow underneath the car to give you the downforce. So you have to make those decisions as whether one is the right direction or the other one. Now, with the high rake, the tire squirt, as we call it, which is where the tire is turning onto the ground, and basically that airflow has to go somewhere. You know, if you take, for example, a wet tire, it turns onto the ground. It has the grooves in there, but it's a huge amount of water and hence air can go through those grooves and out the back of the tire. So the tire squirt on a wet tire is a lot less than the tire squirt on a slick tire. But whatever way, it doesn't really matter. The air that's being squirted out around the sides of the contact patch of the tire is at very, very high velocity. And if you can get some mechanism that connects up the air on the top of the floor to that high velocity airflow that's being squirted around the tire, then it will end up helping you as a seal. So it's all about, it doesn't matter whether it's high rake or low rake, it's all about trying to get that to happen. So I would say perhaps that the high rake itself does generate potentially more downforce. It does give you a bit more room to manage that squirt without the floor height being so restrictive. So maybe there's a little bit more room to make that squirt work better than there is with a low rake car, just because of the difference in the height of the back of the car. You're talking about, you know, 2, maybe 3 centimeters difference. Nothing stupid. It looks a lot, but it's nothing stupid. But it's still enough to make sure that squirt is going in the right place, to be honest. But it, you know, it's a lot of wind tunnel research before you understand it completely.
Another car, Mark, we were looking forward to seeing technically was the Red Bull. I know Gary's been taking a close look at it there, but given the car came into its own as the day went on, looks like they have tackled at least some of their problems of last year, and that the changes they made at the rear seem to be at least basically working.
Well, yeah, and if you took the traits of that car, particularly at the start of the year, sort of this time last year, and put it in the situation it was in today, I don't think it would have looked anything like as good as today's car looked. So, yeah, it appears that they've certainly been able to at least tame the worst characteristics of last year's car, but maybe kept the good points of it.
And Gary, you've been looking very closely at what they've been doing with the suspension. We'll probably have a piece on that on the race.com website. Don't forget the hyphen if you head there in the morning. So what do you make about how they've achieved this Mercedes-esque rear suspension without quite having the necessary tokens to do all the changes they need to do it the full Mercedes way?
Well, as far as I'm aware, they haven't changed the gearbox case and they haven't changed the rear crash structure. So they've lived with what they got, unless anybody knows any different from that. They're very reluctant to tell us what they've done, but I think that's correct. Ed, is that correct at the moment?
Yeah, they won't admit what it is other than it's at the rear of the car. So that can be a number of things. 2 tokens for the gearbox, 2 tokens for the crash structure, but there are other things. You can change rear suspension internals, that costs you tokens as well. So there's a lot of different things you can do to spend it on, but they haven't said. We don't know exactly what they've spent it on.
Well, I mean, we'll have to wait on the final facts, but what I sent in today to you was what I think they could have done with last year's suspension pickups, both in the gearbox and the crash structure, and made a package that was in the direction of what Mercedes did. It's a sort of taking the front wishbone really and mounting it behind the drive shaft, but with their package they would have to come around the drive shaft. Now you can do that inboard. You've got a sort of leeway of a certain amount of distance between the inboard end and the outboard end of each of the wishbones, where you don't have to comply with the regulation of an aspect ratio of 3.5 to 1. So they would have to have done that to come around the drive shaft and get into the strong points on the gearbox. You know, the loads would change for sure, but they wouldn't change stupidly. They'd all still be in the same direction. And they would have to maybe beef up a few bits here and there, and it might be a little bit inefficient making it structurally okay, but it could be done. I think it'd be nice, you know, to do it correctly and to make an analysis correctly, you'd have to sit down and look at it all geometrically and try and work out the loads and see what the difference would be. But I think it could be done. But if they have, you know, if they have changed the gearbox and the crash box or one of those two, then they could do it very, very easily. But they have definitely moved that forward wishbone leg rearward a lot, and it's a single link now, which means it's become the toe link, which is normally behind the drive shaft. So I think they've achieved the goal. How they've achieved it, we really don't know yet.
Yeah, that's something that will probably become clear as the season goes on. One other, I wary of calling it a technical story, but it was the last car we hadn't seen. The Haas VF21 appeared this morning. Anybody want to get excited about that? Come on, Mark, you can try and find some positives in the dramatically different Haas. A few little subtle changes, but they haven't even bothered to spend their tokens, and pretty much what we expected, really, wasn't it, from a team that's just treading water this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's reshaped the sort of upper part, the side pods and the engine cover, just like everybody else has this year. Looks like, you know, done a fully competent job there. The car ran a lot of laps today. Relatively trouble-free by the look of it. So, yeah, I mean, they were very, very unambitious with this car, weren't they? So I guess the best you can say is it ran okay.
Yeah, for me, there was two drivers out there today that I think impressed me in general. One was Yuki Tsunoda getting in, and obviously after lunchtime, the sand on the track and that was horrendous, but he was on it quick and didn't make any mistakes. And Nikita Mazepin, I mean, he definitely got on it as well. So doing the best job with what he's got, you could say was the objective of today, and he definitely did that. So I think it's going to be one of those sort of situations where the battle between the two teammates is going to be a pretty tight battle, to be honest, between the two Haas drivers. And I think that's going to be their big challenge for this year, just to see which one of those two comes out on top. I think Mazepin is much quicker to adapt than Mick Schumacher to a situation, because he just drives a bit more like a gorilla. He just gets in and does it. Whereas Mick Schumacher seems to be a bit more of a planning driver, but it'd be interesting to see who gets terms with it faster.
We hit the middle point of pre-season testing at lunchtime tomorrow. It's going past very quickly. So I thought I'd ask you both what you would like to see happening tomorrow in terms of some of the questions you want to see answered. I guess the first thing we want is slightly more stable and representative conditions, because that's what we need to answer those questions. But Mark, what are you looking forward to finding out?
Oh, I'd like to see a straightforward comparison, straightforward run for run between the Mercedes and the Red Bull, and well, also the Aston and the McLaren as well, because they look the cars to that we should be paying attention to from what we've seen so far. So, yeah, I'd just like to get a better handle on where we are, really.
And how about you, Gary? I know one of your answers is going to be even more photos, detailed photos of certain parts of the car, and we're working on that. We'll get them. But what else?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of detailed stuff we can still go through. But I think, you know, like Mark says, a good shootout, but I don't think we'll see a good shootout. I don't think anybody will bother, because in reality, you know, well, there will be people bothered, but they're not going to be people that are going to be sitting in the pole position, I don't think, come 2 weeks' time. But the real competition comes into the fact of learning as much about the car as you can. And it's about the consistency of lap time as well, and how easy it is to do the lap time. If you can go out, you know, with a set of fresh tyres on and head out to do a lap, and you can do it on your first lap, then the car is very drivable. The other thing I'd like to sort of look at is speed traps. I mean, we've got today, Danny Ricciardo was relatively the fastest. I mean, Roy Nissany was faster in the Williams, but it doesn't relate to lap time. But Daniel Ricciardo was at 3:329.9. And then, you know, we go down to Charles Leclerc, which is where we've been talking about Ferrari engines for quite a while, 3:25.8. So, you know, 4 kilometres between Leclerc's Ferrari and the Mercedes of Daniel Ricciardo. But, you know, it's difficult to know, because Hamilton was down in 3:22. I'm pretty sure that Hamilton would be running a lot more fuel than Daniel Ricciardo, and they never really took an opportunity to do a lap time. But we need to keep an eye on those straight line speeds, because they are going to be important relative to the overall performance of the engine horsepower wise and the car itself efficiency wise. Ferrari, I don't think, have shown that they're quite where they should be yet. But we'll see. I think it's a matter of watching how they trim the car to suit, how all the teams trim the cars to suit, and trying to get the best out of it as far as lap time and straight line speed is concerned. So it might be Sunday before we find that, when we have a day that's not quite so windy, not quite so sandy, and everybody's more attuned with the new car and the circuit, so we can look at straight line speeds relative to lap time.
Yeah, I think Ferrari is quite an interesting one to get a feel for as well. They've clearly made gains with the engines, but not as much as they need to. So the real question for them is if they can get to the front of that midfield pack properly, which they absolutely have to do. So that's going to be one of the interesting questions to answer. You'll be able to follow it all on therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen. There's loads to read on there. Mark Hughes' time analysis, loads of articles from Gary looking at the McLaren barge boards and the Haas and the detail of the Mercedes floor. So there's plenty to read there technically. And of course, Scott Mitchell, who is our absent friend on this podcast, but will probably be back tomorrow, has been working away at all sorts of interesting things. And also tomorrow we'll have a live Q&A with Gary Anderson on the site. So post your questions on the article there and he'll do his best to get through them. So do keep listening to the podcast. We'll have one each day, and also check out our sister titles like Bring Back V10s, and also take a look at our YouTube channel, because there's loads to watch on there, including a video from the first day of testing that, if it's not published by the time you listen to this, we'll be very close to appearing. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more from Bahrain F1 testing.